And that's the kicking music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. This week, we'll tackle a movie that doesn't take easily to tackling Peter Jackson's The Hobbit: An Unexpected Journey. It's got big feet. It's almost 3 hours long. Can it be graceful anyway? And then we'll move on to a topic near and dear to the heart of every pop culture collector. What do you do with all your stuff? And finally, we'll close, as always, with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Trey Graham, what do you do at NPR?
I edit movies coverage for NPR.org.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
Well, you know, I feel like we just did this together. We are taping this on Monday, and on Saturday was our live event, which you will have an opportunity to hear when it goes out over the podcast feed in a week or so. But I think it's safe to say we had a wonderful time.
I would call it a smashing success.
We had a great time. It was quite crowded, and we're so grateful to all of you who tolerated the heat and the crowd, because, boy, I feel you on that. and hung around to listen and to play our quiz.
Uh-huh. And to say hello afterwards. Yeah, just an unbelievable cross-section of wonderful, wonderful people.
It was.
Just tons of great interaction, tons of crowd energy. It was very interesting to get sort of a second-by-second dose of feedback on anything you're saying.
Yeah, now that they're not here, I miss them.
I realized very quickly when I was coming to bore people.
I will say, even me, I was dubious going into this, not so much for the live show, but for the afterwards of the live show. But it turns out that having like-minded, and I think that's key, like-minded, smart, funny people come up to you and tell you that the goofy little flea circus you do doesn't completely waste their time. And then the key thing there after that is, after that, to engage them in what podcasts do you like, what books are you reading, what comics do you like. I mean, that was, well, it didn't suck. I'll just put it that way. Didn't
so
entirely suck.
Glenn's heart grew 3 sizes.
I wish somebody would have told me that would happen. Stephen Thompson.
Interaction with humans. Yeah. It's a good thing.
Yeah. You look to be having a good time. And as I said to a couple people over the weekend, hearing people laugh is not the worst thing that has ever happened to me. So at any rate,
I am an engine that runs solely on validation.
Yeah. Well.
Speaking of the worst thing that's ever happened to me, just kidding. So we all saw The Hobbit. Mm-hmm. It came up briefly during our live event, but we did think we would do a bit of a deep dive into this deep dive of a movie.
Yes.
I think it's only appropriate to start with Glenn.
I would rather you go around the table, weigh in, and then I will tell you why you're wrong.
All right. Well, Stephen, you went, and I know that you took your kids.
Mm-hmm.
And for those of you who don't know, they're 8 and 11.
Yeah. And none of my family, myself included, is in any way steeped in the Lord of the Rings averse. I will confess right now, I have not actually seen the Lord of the Rings movies.
Wow.
You're
the one.
I know.
No, I haven't either.
My only interaction with that entire world, besides having been taken to science fiction conventions as a child, is having been taken to the Ralph Bakshi Lord of the Rings.
Ooh.
As a child. At about, my mother will tell you, probably around the point in the movie when I actually turned my coat, which had a hood, and turned it backwards so that my hood would cover my face so I wouldn't have to see it anymore.
Yeah.
This is better than that.
Good, good.
Not much.
Oh, man.
How did you find it?
I think the last 40 minutes of this movie I was on board with pretty fully. The first hour and 57 minutes of this movie was basically there's a point, and I checked my watch to mark off the point, when Bilbo Baggins says, "I'm going on an adventure," 40 minutes into this movie. Why? Why? Is it just being faithful to the text?
I explained this to Stephen.
Because I
want to hear me explain it?
Yeah, go ahead.
It's the hero's journey. He has to resist the call.
Yep.
He has to initially resist the call.
Does it take 40 minutes to resist a call? I feel like you could just say no, and then they'd be like, yes, and then he goes.
It takes 40 minutes to resist the call and do the dishes.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Seriously, with the dishes.
I liked the dishes.
Well, what did you think?
At times, pacing-wise, at times this movie makes The Tree of Life look like Argo.
All right.
There are points in this movie that I found stultifyingly paced. And basically, then about 2 hours in, all of a sudden they get to the fireworks factory. And not that there aren't battles and chase scenes before that, but it doesn't fully kick in. And I found myself at the point where I kind of realized, like, wait, this is the first movie in a trilogy. They're not actually going to resolve the things that movies like this generally resolve when they get to this point. And I found it very frustrating, all the things that it did that I felt it didn't have to do. I felt it was bound up by faithfulness to its source material in ways that were to the detriment of the movie.
Okay.
How about you, Trey?
Well, I liked it rather more, I think, than Steven and Linda did. It is longish, and I understand why it's longish. It's because they're doing a deep dive into the appendices, as I believe Glenn has mentioned before. Uh-huh. But, you know, I'm a nerd like that. I like to wallow in the details. So I can't remember from reading the book, because it's been many, many years. But the brown wizard sequence, that's uh-huh. from the appendix, right?
Yes.
He doesn't actually turn up in the
right.
main story matter. But he was a fun, eccentric character, and I like the way he was realized. And really, I'm sorry, bunnies pulling a sleigh?
I definitely found it long. I definitely found parts of it trying. But my concern about my own, you know, I do try to interrogate my own opinion a little bit
sure.
about things like this. And although I found it long, I did find parts of it delightful.
Mm-hmm.
I think the riddle sequence with Martin Freeman and Andy Serkis as Gollum is really terrific.
That's where the movie completely takes
off. Very engaging.
Yeah.
I would have watched a lot more of that. There were definitely a few visual elements that I thought were striking and really cool. I thought the stone giants fighting were really, really cool. I liked the way that all came together. My frustration with it, and I mentioned to Glenn, because I saw this movie with Glenn, and one of the things I mentioned to him was I got frustrated at the beginning because the part of the book that I read,
the first four pages,
which is not as rumored, the first four pages, I read, you know, probably about a third of the book. And in the part of the book that I read, it doesn't start with this long prologue of fighting and battles and mythology.
Right.
It just jumps in at the part where in the movie it takes probably 7 or 8 minutes to get to, where you get to, you know, once upon a time there was a little hobbit hole or whatever he says. But it's the same frustration I had at the beginning of Thor, and it's the same frustration I had at the beginning of even the Richard Donner Superman, a movie that I love,
mm-hmm.
which is when they start with these big myth-making, let me tell you what the stakes are, why mm-hmm. this is all important. I get very kind of, I tune out. I don't like that. And my concern about my reaction to this film, although it's a little bit, there are some differences between a superhero movie and a movie like this, and
sure.
some great similarities in terms of, as I was just saying, the hero's journey, as I've learned from Glenn and all that business. I do not like it. And actually what got me thinking about this was Les Miserables. I do not like it when people watch an example of a form and they dislike it because of things that are part of the form.
Mm.
And they, for example, every time I read a review that's like, I'm sorry, I just can't take musicals seriously because all of a sudden people just burst into song. It's just so dumb. It just seems crazy to me. Or they give themselves points for sort of like, I could overlook the fact that everyone is bursting into song. You can't hold the form against an example of the form. And my concern about this movie, about other fantasy movies, when I've talked about how, as I first put it, I don't like creatures. I don't like big, hairy feet.
Right.
I'm concerned that the things that I don't like about it
are things you don't like about
any are things
movie
I don't like
this.
About this kind of movie. And I feel like certainly if it had been a little shorter,
mm-hmm.
I would have probably responded to it better. My beef with it, which I know I've mentioned to Steven, is that I do feel like there are parts of it that the comparison I made was if The Princess Bride, every time you had something where, like, Wesley said, well, here's what happened with the Dread Pirate Roberts, you had to go back and have the entire thing and see the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And every time and when Inigo talked about the six-fingered man, you had to go back for a long sequence. And I feel like Peter Jackson gets addicted to depicting everything.
Mm-hmm.
He loves it so much. He loves doing it so much. He loves building things. He loves making things. He loves the beauty of this universe so much that he wants to go out and depict everything. He can't just have anyone describe something. You know, nothing can come from dialogue. Everything has to come from seeing it yourself.
Right.
I think that's kind of my beef with it.
Right, because you have to show and tell. You can't do one or the other exclusively.
But I'm a little concerned that my impatience with it is just part of how I respond to this kind of story, that these kind of, like,
you know, when you open it up and you're kind of like, well, you have to understand, first there were these guys and then there were those guys. And here's the story of how the little story.
Hey, they
of...
show you a map right away.
Exactly. I'm concerned. I fear that my own opinion is only valid for people who don't like this form.
Yeah, I mean, you're engaging with the movie on a certain level. And that's really what the best anybody can expect of somebody who's not well-versed in this thing. Because certainly my reaction is different from anybody's in this room, I think. Because my first initial reaction, which is why a lot of what I'm about to say should be completely discounted, is gratitude. I want to spend more time in this world. 9 hours plus the extended DVD wasn't enough for me. And the fact that it's Peter Jackson who is investing money, he's throwing a lot of money at the screen, to create this world and round it out. I mean, my first reaction is gratitude. It's interesting to hear you, Stephen, and now, Linda, you didn't see the other Lord of the Rings films either?
I didn't, no.
Okay. Because the criticism I'm hearing from you guys, and also from a lot of the critical community, is exactly the criticism I was braced for exactly 11 years ago, almost to the day when Fellowship of the Ring came out. This is how I expected people would greet that film, because it had been for so many years a sort of insular little thing where intense nerds really loved it and were incredibly well-versed in it, but it's really about hairy feet and wizards and all this kind of stuff that just didn't seem like it would... Even if you're throwing all kinds of media hype around it and all kinds of promotion and spending a lot of money on the movie, I still wasn't anticipating the films to be embraced as much as they are. Right. And what you notice about this film is that it is almost a beat-for-beat, minute-by-minute recapitulation of The Fellowship of the Ring. Structurally, it's exactly the same. Mm-hmm. There is that overture at the beginning, which goes into back history, that if you're not prepped for it, it will just sail right over your head. There's the bucolic shire, where there's like the tin whistle and the... and then there's leaving the shire, which happens at exactly the same moment as it did in The Fellowship of the Ring. There's the first threat in The Fellowship of the Ring. It's a Nazgul. Here it's an orc. Then there's a chase to get into Rivendell, where the film stops dead, so that people can sit around a table and discuss an object. In Fellowship of the Ring, it was a ring. Here, it was a Morgoth blade. But it's exactly beat for beat. And then they go up to the mountains. Something happens in the mountains. And they go into the mines. It's just exactly...
And then you're about halfway through, you're like, what's that? Oh, it's a woman.
Yeah. Imagine that. The devil, you say. It is mapped onto this exactly. And what is different, however, is the tone.
Yes.
This is a kid's book. So a lot of the things that are dark and sinister...
And so, spoiler alert, no one dies.
Well, I mean... There's that. But also in The Fellowship of the Ring and in the original series, there's Nazgul, who are these evil, dark, scary guys. And here you have a goblin king played by Barry Humphreys, played by Dame Edna with a goiter, who is sort of joking around. So the stakes are much, much, much lower. And I think you notice that. I think that takes some of the power away from it.
I think that's a really good point. Because, you know, I found myself agreeing with you, even though I haven't seen the original Lord of the Rings movies. I thought to myself, there's no way the original Lord of the Rings movies have this kind of do-do-do-do-do-do that this has, which at times... There's a strange kind of Jar Jar-ish silliness to this movie that doesn't support the epic length of the movie, for one thing. This movie feels to me like not just paced wrong, but padded. Like it's padded in order to make it seem epic.
Right.
Like they could have told the story in two movies, but wanted to make a 40-minute dishes scene.
Right. Well, what you're picking up on... See, when I have to see this film again, because when I saw, certainly, The Fellowship of the Ring, I was thinking of all the stuff they had taken out. And some of the stuff they took out was like, good riddance, Tom Bombadil, you don't belong in this movie. Because that has... You don't know who that is, but it has the boop-a-doop-a-doo kind of stuff that they just cut out of that. Here, I kept noticing what they're putting in, what they're taking from the appendix, what they brought from the Silmarillion, what they did all this other stuff. And it feels to me like it's stuff shoehorned in, even though it's exactly following almost minute by minute the exact structure of the original Fellowship of the Ring, which again was about launching an epic, which was about starting off. So I do feel like the second and third films in the series are going to have a different tone, because even though it's still lighter, it's going to get darker. Some of those dwarves are going to die. And it's just going to get darker and more. It's never going to match this sort of dread that pervades the Lord of the Rings, because it's the stakes are so much higher. But yeah, I dug it. What can I say?
Is this film like more of a geek deep dive into that world? I mean, there were points, you know, I went with my kids and I sort of felt almost like I was the parent where you catch your kid smoking a cigarette and so you make him smoke the whole carton. And this is what you do if you catch your kid like with 10-sided dye.
Yeah.
You take them to this movie.
Yeah. I guess, you know, for me, the issue with the length was primarily that the entire time that, you know, when Glenn and I have gone back and forth about The Hobbit and about his sort of encouragement that if you're going to try it, try The Hobbit, right? Because it's this, it's a kid's book. It's a light story. It's a much sort of less massive, less epic.
It's an adventure, not an epic, right?
So to me, to go in there and feel like it's 3 hours long and there's two more movies left, to me it felt like I would have much rather, I mean, I guess what I wanted was an introduction to this world that didn't have that big, giant, lumbering quality that I felt like it still wound up having.
Right.
So I was a little bit, you know, bummed out by that. And then, you know, there are always a couple of small things that you notice that are like, why don't you just call the giant birds in the first place?
Oh, my God, seriously.
Right. Yeah. And why don't the giant birds take them that extra mile to the mountain?
Seriously. Yeah, yeah, I'm like, you can just skip over the second movie that it's going to take to get from one mountain to the other.
But again, this is the part where I feel like I know perfectly well that I'm doing like the, and then E.T. bicycles across the moon.
Are we supposed to assume that this is some sort of magic xylophone?
I'm so sure. In the book, the eagles have their own sort of society and they have to broker a truce, you know, and there's all, didn't want to do talking birds. See, that's the thing. Like, if he was making it kid movie, he would have made talking birds. But he doesn't do that here. The other big criticism this movie is getting is about the 48 frames per second. Did you guys see it?
Yeah, I wanted to ask about that because it came out in, what, 5 different formats?
Yeah, something like that.
I specifically targeted the cheapest one. Mm-hmm. So I didn't see it in, was it HSR, HD, 3D, IMAX?
There's plenty of.
We did, right?
We did see it in that.
Because I could tell it looked different.
So I can't speak to that. How was that a different experience besides cost?
It looks pretty tremendous. I specifically went to the IMAX theater so I could see the 9-minute Star Trek trailer. And it looks pretty phenomenal. We saw it in 3D, so it's, you know, there's obviously that little bit of haze that you get from sitting a little too close to the 3D screen and the kind of dim film that you get from the glasses.
Did you have the feeling that, you know, and maybe it's just from seeing a lot of big CGI spectacles, it's not quite an uncanny valley thing with CGI, but you do sort of feel like I'm watching elaborate CGI.
Well, there's a film, traditional film, kind of has this, not a haze, but it sort of gives everything a nice warm glow,
which is
lacking here. And I think what I noticed about this was not that it's better or worse, but that it is inconsistent. So the scenes that were shot in the dark underneath the mountain looked fantastic, but those scenes which were in full daylight outside, those were so crisp as to look like video. And this is what everybody's saying.
I would agree with that. Now that you say that, I realize it was the more brightly lit scenes. They seemed like video or a video game. That to me, the feeling I got was the video game look. And I think a lot of films flirt with that line anyway, with feeling like a video game. And if I noticed anything about the 48 frames per second, which my understanding is the screening that Glenn and I saw was the 48, it certainly looked different to me. If I noticed anything about it, it was that those brightly lit scenes and that kind of slightly odd thing gave me more of almost an uncanny valley feeling about real people. It was sort of like you're watching an actor and yet it looks like it's somehow constructed.
Yeah, you get this sense of it's a little bit hard to fully immerse yourself in the world because you can almost see the green screen.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, this is effects movies. This is not just this effects movie.
Right.
But there were a lot of summer movie trailers before this thing, and it was all a bunch of incredibly loud, shiny CGI spectacles. It's more personal bias.
And you know, I think one of the reasons why I like the stone giant,
that was a really cool scene,
is that because they're sort of somewhat monochromatic and because they don't have real sharp features, I don't notice it as much. I mean, I still certainly notice that it's not real rocks, you know what I mean? But because it sort of is a mass of stone that's animated in a certain way, I don't think I notice it as much as I do when they're trying to draw every hair on a troll. I think those in some ways are
every
the times...
Every postulating sore on a troll.
I think those are some of the times when I notice it the most. Whereas if it's a big pile of rock, then I notice it actually a little bit less.
It does a disservice to New Zealand, of all places, because I have seen the first trilogy millions of times, and you just are struck by the natural beauty of New Zealand. Here, the mountains, which are real mountains, look so crisp as to look, as Stephen was saying, like CGI. Yeah.
This movie also employed more nose putty than Cloud Atlas.
More nose putty and many, many very intricate beards.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, the other thing people are saying is that you can't tell the different dwarves apart. I could only tell there was the lead dwarf, Smoldery. Then there's Exposition-y. Mm-hmm. Hattie, Fatty, who, by the way, let's just all agree, Harry Knowles. That guy.
Yes.
I mean, it's shameless.
Friar Harry Knowles.
That's right. Hottie 1, Hottie 2, and Emo Phillips.
Yeah. let me just jump ahead to the end of the show and tell you that what's making me happy this week is Philly and Killy.
Yeah.
Did we do Robert Prosky?
Oh, I didn't know. That's expositioning.
Yes, true.
Yeah, oh, that's very good. True.
That's very true.
I just, obscure reference. Feel free to look up Robert Prosky.
No, you're right.
Rest in peace.
Also, least sexy movie since Showgirls.
That's true.
Until you get to Rivendell and Kate Blanchett is rotating on a turntable.
For like 45 seconds.
Right. There is a scene with Lee Pace looking haughty on a moose, which which is great.
Looking haughty
on a moose.
I
just started giggling.
Yeah. Well, I would be very curious to hear how broadly these perceptions are shared by both those of you who are Tolkien fans and those of you who are newbies such as myself, if any of you actually have ventured out. If there are any of you left, other than me and Stephen.
I was going to say, I feel like we are over-representing the non-Lord of the Rings
people. We certainly are. But find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or at the blog at npr.org/PCHH and let us know what you thought of The Hobbit. Now, our next topic today, it's the end of the year. It's cleaning time for many of us. It's time to,
It's New Year's resolution.
It's both New Year's resolution time, so you kind of want to get rid of a lot of your stuff. It's also gift-giving time for many people.
So you want to re-gift a lot of
your stuff. So you want to re-gift a lot of your stuff. What we got talking about was storage. Now, part of this came up because of my recent apartment flood, and Stephen and I had been talking about sort of managing the massive amount of, in my case, a lot of it is DVD screeners and stuff like that that people have sent me that I can't bear to give away, but also don't want to keep in a gigantic pile of basic cable screeners forever, but somehow I don't get rid of them. So what I was going to start with is by asking Stephen, because I know you are a guy who has to own a real object, right?
Yeah. So, I've been going through sort of a soul-searching process somewhat related to what you went through, Linda, with the flood, which is that I recently got a bunch of my stuff out of storage and found that a great deal of it had been absolutely soaked with cat urine.
And this is a running theme for you.
This is a running theme for me. I cannot dodge them. I feel like if I rent a storage unit, there will be roving stray cats will get into it and urinate on it. So I had this process of picking through a lot of my possessions, and thankfully nothing of tremendous importance was ruined. So there was a certain amount, again, like the house, where the cats have helped with sort of a winnowing process. They sort of say, you don't need the magazines you kept on your desk at the Onion seven years ago and haven't touched. So I've been kind of trying to kick myself into a place where I suddenly, a switch is flipped and I'm less sentimental and feeling the need to hold on to everything. Mm-hmm. I have not yet moved to the notion of the cloud, where I can store everything on the wind and, where
on the wind.
Where I feel like it could be taken away from me by gatekeepers. You know, I definitely have a very deeply ingrained, and this is hereditary, where I have picked up from my parents a desire to have everything at my fingertips all the time. Mm-hmm. But I don't necessarily trust, perhaps there's a sunspot wipes out the entire internet or something, where I haven't been able to reach a point where I'm ready to let go of my things, even though I feel like I spend more time acquiring things than I spend enjoying things. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Now, is it sentiment, or are you one of these, when it comes to music, are you one of these audiophiles who are like, oh, vinyl is so much warmer and MP3s suck?
I'm not a vinyl is so much warmer guy, because vinyl, first of all, as a cat owner, forget it with the vinyl. I mean, vinyl can be ruined so... I don't like things that can be instantly ruined by one swipe of a cat's paw. So I let go of vinyl quite a while ago, but I do find that I love the silver discs. Mm-hmm. I am probably to CDs what a lot of vinyl people, you know, have been to vinyl, probably just a shade, who are just a shade older than me.
Right.
You know, I made the switch over to CD when I was about, from vinyl to CD when, and cassette to CD when I was about 15.
Yeah.
And so I don't necessarily have that, like, oh man, the warmth, you know, but I don't necessarily trust, you know, that I really have it if it's in MP3 form.
But here's the thing. The silver disc just holds the same digital files that a hard drive would.
But uncompressed.
Uncompressed, files. Yeah.
Sure. But, I mean, you're still counting on the fact that you'll still be able to access those digital. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
Those
well, and there files. Are CDs. I have been going through a lot of old CDs lately and came across my Edith Piaf box set, about half of which had contracted what is called disc rot that had ruined fully half of the discs. You know, it's a 20-year-old box set.
I'm not talking about
actual degradation of the CD.
I'm not talking about sound quality when I say a CD is just digital files and a. What I'm saying is it's all somewhat intangible.
It's certainly, yeah.
And I'm not sure that the actual CD is any more indestructible than a really good hard drive would be that was backed up. Do you know what I mean?
You're trying to talk me out. Well, you're trying to talk me into through the process of letting go.
No. I'm trying to get you to, I'm trying to pry into the need to possess a physical item about which I think you are sentimental. And I think, like you say, I think you like the silver discs, not only because of the I don't really trust the cloud and all that stuff, but you just like them because you like them.
Right.
You like them because they mean something to you. And that's why you have a billion of them in your house.
there is that. I mean, I do think
it's an estimate.
The sense of sort of tangible ownership of something. And I do like packaging. I like the look of these things. And as music is dispensed more and more entirely as a nebulous data file, as much as I love music and I'm obsessed with music and listen to music all the time, I do like the sense of holding something in my hand. It feels much more like ownership.
Hmm. How about you, Glenn? Are you a digital guy? Are you an analog
guy? You're a much less sentimental person.
Oh, my God. I just... convenience is the thing I prize more than anything else. I have not bought a physical comic in a year.
Really?
I'm downloading them all.
So you are a comics enthusiast, not a comics collector.
That's right.
Which is a distinction we have discussed at some length.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And I still go to my local to get the trade paperbacks of things I haven't gotten yet. But, I mean, I just love pressing a button and having a comic appear on a tablet.
I'm that way, too.
And when it comes to DVDs, like, we own DVDs that we should not own because, like, why do we own Speed? Because Speed is on TNT, like, three times a day.
Yeah.
And also, you can download it with Apple TV and Hulu and Netflix. It's all there. I am the credulous guy who's like, well, I trust big, huge, evil corporations. Well, but they'll take care of me.
I just feel like there's going to come some sort of apocalyptic event, and all the nerds are going to amass at my door like zombies because they're going to know I've got those DVDs.
Of course.
That's true.
Only thing
I'm the only one who's got them, man.
I'm coming to your house in the apocalypse, and it's because you'll still have the things I like to watch on DVD.
You can create a bunker out of the old CD cases. For me, the only reason I would actually buy a physical DVD, for example, or a Blu-ray in this case, is for revisiting it. It's a thing I know I want to revisit.
Mm-hmm.
Or, in the case of The Hobbit, I'm buying that thing because I want the special features.
Right.
I want to waste another 3 hours on that.
You want to see Andy Serkis, you know, in his little bodysuit.
I want to see Richard Taylor, who's the head of Weta Workshop, who's going to be telling us this is a mithril blade.
I want to see him because he's the biggest nerd in the world, and he just looks like he's having so much fun, and I can only see him with the special features. But that's it. I mean, that is absolutely it. I just... There's no reason. There's no reason to have the thing.
One of the things that's interesting is I used to see a lot of commentaries and stuff like that on movies, on TV shows. I realized the other day now I see them hardly ever.
Mm-hmm.
Because the things I like, the things I want to have the ability to watch whenever I want in terms of a TV show or something, I'll just buy from Amazon Instant Video and I'll be able to pull them up on my TV, which is great.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't come with all those features. It doesn't come with commentary. It doesn't come with... So I wind up looking up blooper reels on YouTube because I love blooper reels.
No, I love a blooper
reel. And so I wonder whether features and other doodads are... I wonder how long they can sort of keep the DVD market afloat. You know what I mean?
And I used to be the guy who used to say, oh, the director's commentary, they add so much. And then now that I'm not listening to them anymore, I don't miss them. I mean, you'll find a great one every once in a while, but most of the time is, oh, she was really great to work with. You know,
right.
And that's that
kind
of stuff.
She's terrific.
Oh, man, look at that. That's not a thing.
Well, I mean, I also just, I dream of this world where we're all much more portable. We all, you know, certainly we, you know, from an environmental standpoint, sort of use less, you know, make smaller footprints. And how, you know, if I needed to up and relocate, I wouldn't have to move thousands of CDs and all that stuff. And I really do, as I, you know, as I get older and I'm on that slow march to the grave, certainly with a stop at a retirement home where they're going to throw all my CDs in a dumpster. You know, sort of being able to. Am I being too morbid?
Possibly a little.
But you know, I do love the idea of sort of having everything in one place, and if nothing else, like sort of having backups of my life. But I go nuts just from a standpoint of like I've saved every newspaper that everything I've ever written appears in.
Oh yeah, I quit doing that years ago.
And you know, I used to think print is forever, though the internet is ephemeral, and it's actually the complete opposite.
Right.
But now I feel like I can't just throw that stuff out because I could back it up. But at the same time, like, are my kids ever going to want to read the stuff I wrote for my college newspaper? No.
But future historians, Stephen.
Yeah, exactly. and that's
more over your...
Actually, this incredibly egotist. I don't want to read that stuff. I think it's garbage. I hate it. I wrote it. It's bad. You know,
this is the advantage to only ever having really written on the internet, because then things are either there or they're not there. And there's things that I wrote that aren't there anymore. There's things that I wrote that, I mean, I don't print everything and save everything. And there are people who hear that and say, oh my God, are you kidding me? It could all go poof tomorrow. And I say, yeah, it could all go poof tomorrow.
This kind of connects in a sort of a way to what we were talking about a few episodes back and Linda's essay about you can't consume everything.
Right.
Right? You also can't keep everything, and you certainly can't revisit everything,
right?
If you're going to have any kind of a life.
Right.
So I've got little to add to this because I'm totally Glenn. I'm like, push the button, give it to me.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And with many of these services, you can then delete it from your device, and if you want to get it again because you've already bought it, they'll send it to you again.
Mm-hmm.
I guess. And, you know, that's the thing. I got to get over this whole mindset of, like, there's this mythical Stephen Thompson library somewhere. You know, that, like...
To which you're going to donate that, like, all your papers.
The Historical Society is really going to require my old Daily Cardinal reviews, you know?
Your papers.
The papers of Stephen Thompson.
Yeah, I mean, we have obviously had this conversation lots and lots of times about books and the fact that I'm an ebook person and the tremendous attachment that people have to paper books. But
and to books and to bookstores and to music stores and to DVD stores.
Well, and you know, some of this links into what we were talking about last week with film culture, which is, you know, for some people, bookstores are part of a book culture, which is a bigger thing than the ownership of the physical book. And it's not just that. The other issue that I do see with some of these things is it is a lot harder to lend your stuff around if you have, with certain kinds of things, it's not. With music, it's really easy to burn somebody a copy of things.
Right.
If you haven't, you know, jailbroken your e-reader or whatever, it's not as easy to be like, I'm going to loan my Kindle book to somebody else. And I definitely acknowledge that as a limitation.
In other ways, however, those limitations on sharing have an effect that's counter to what people often say about technology and small devices, which is that it's dissociative. Because I can't share my digitally downloaded movies, I have begun having a movie night at my house occasionally.
Right.
And friends come over and we sit in front of the big TV and I stream them from the iPad to the TV.
I was going to say, I've never been invited to that. But also, you know, God forbid, people have to buy stuff instead of stealing.
Right. Yes.
Yeah, it's a complicated thing. But for me, getting my physical possessions down to a much smaller amount of stuff is worth everything, because I tend to live in a relatively small amount of space.
Mm-hmm.
And from my perspective, anything I can get out the door is welcome to leave, as long as I will still be able to watch it or read it or whatever.
And I think
get it out. Get it out.
It's a great mindset. And it's sort of, I guess, the closest thing I have to a New Year's resolution is to try to get rid of as much stuff as possible, just to feel like, you know, I'm not, you know, going to wind up like Grey Gardens.
Yeah. I think
if Grey Gardens were soaked in cat urine.
It
kind of was in Raccoon
Urine.
I think we did talk at one point about the possibility that you would one day be found entombed in your CD collection. At any rate, you know, once again, we would love to hear what you think. So come find us on Facebook or find us on the blog and let us know your thoughts about storing, keeping, tossing, throwing, hurling, recycling.
I bet some people will suggest that the people who want to revisit stuff could go to their local library.
That is absolutely true. A fine weapon in the battle against accumulating stuff. Well, that brings us to our final segment this week and every week. What is making us happy this week? Glenn Weldon, what's making you happy this week?
The film Queen of Versailles purports to be a documentary about a family of billionaires who struggle, and let's put scare quotes around that word, struggle
indeed
to scale back their grotesque overconsumption in the wake of the economic crisis. If it was actually a documentary about that, you'd be asked to sympathize with venal, repellent people who have no souls. Happily, if you do what I did, when you find yourself getting angry and you pause the movie and you have a drink or six, when you turn it on again, it becomes the driest Christopher Guest joint you're ever going to see, starring Jennifer Coolidge, a fabulous Jennifer Coolidge, and a remarkably restrained Fred Willard. And then it's funny. Then it is merely funny, and you do not feel rage at this movie. But, yeah, so Queen of Versailles was making me angry happy.
I loved that movie. And I think what's interesting about it is, yes, they are repellent, horrible people. But there are moments when you realize that in there is a human, to me. To me, there actually are moments where you realize that in there somewhere is a person, but buried very deep under such ridiculous
lacquer.
Expectations about, well, yeah, lacquer too, but such ridiculous expectations about what a person is entitled to. And when they are sort of the central thrust of the movie has a lot to do with them having to sell this second house, this bigger house that they've been building, because they lived in a mansion, but they wanted a bigger mansion that was going to be the biggest single family home ever built in the United States. And it may still be, assuming that it was sold as a single family home, or I don't know exactly what became of it. But then Versailles is essentially, it's modeled on Versailles, this bigger house that they were building because their other house wasn't big enough. And when you sort of see what they had planned, and there's this, my favorite moment in the movie is where they explain the children, they've got a whole mess of kids. And the woman explains at one point, I would only have had one or two kids if I didn't think I could have nannies.
Right.
But since I could have nannies, as many as I wanted, I just kept having kids. So now she has like seven kids.
She doesn't know.
They've let most of the nannies go. And what happens is she's talking at one point about how
they fired the lion's share of the nannies.
She's talking about how in the new house, the children will have their own wing of the house where all the kids' rooms will be, which you can sort of understand, right? The kids' rooms would all be in one part of the house until this moment where she's walking up these big, grand stairs and she says, these are the stairs I would walk up if I was going to visit the children.
If I were
going to visit the children, to visit my children who live in my house.
I've got a custodial visit.
If I were going to visit the children, I just recommend the heck out of that movie.
It's gross, but it's fascinating.
And you can stream it from sort of the usual suspects, and it is wonderful and unsettling. Trey Graham, what's making you happy this week?
In the wake of the shootings in Connecticut, a photograph and a quote went viral. And the photograph was of Mr. Rogers and a little kid. Mm-hmm. And the quote was something that he had said, advice that he gave to people dealing with similarly sad situations. Mm-hmm. And the fact that this got resurfaced and that the photograph is so beautiful.
It is. Black and white photograph of him and a little...
Yeah, a little toe-headed kid. Mm-hmm. Who's just radiating joy at the fact that he's meeting Mr. Rogers. The fact that this went viral and sort of touched so many people is what's making me happy, and I wanted to read the quote. When I was a boy and I would see scary things in the news, my mother would say to me, look for the helpers. You will always find people who are helping. To this day, especially in times of disaster, I remember my mother's words, and I am always comforted by realizing that there are still so many helpers, so many caring people in this world.
Mr. Rogers, fantastic.
Yeah. Right. And it came around and reconnected with me today, on Monday, because there's a story in the Washington Post by a writer with whom I'm acquainted. Her name is Mara Judkis, and it turns out that her father took that photo. So she's got a column today in Monday's Washington Post, which we will link to the web version of, and you can read the backstory of the photograph.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, it's a beautiful quote.
It is a beautiful quote and a beautiful photograph, and I try, and it's a good thing to keep in mind all the time.
All the time.
You know, world is full of nice people.
Absolutely.
We met a whole bunch of them.
Yes, we did.
And we're encouraged and buoyed by it. Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this
week?
Well,
I have nothing so moving.
Yeah, it's a tough act to follow.
The Green Bay Packers won the NFC North.
Trey has put us in a slightly difficult position here, but that's okay.
I mean, obviously the wonderful live show was fantastic. I can't wait to hear how it turned out. Today is Monday, and it is a minor but significant milestone. It is the 10th anniversary of the publication of the only book I have ever edited.
Oh, yeah?
And really good. Not counting books I've copy edited or written introductions for, but a book that, the way Glenn, for example, did you know that Glenn Weldon wrote a book?
Oh, come on.
Did I?
And every time Glenn would talk about the experience of his book and how, like, oh, I got the cover and I got, you know, I totally understood exactly what you meant. You pour years into this thing. And December 17th, 2002 was the publication date of The Tenacity of the Cockroach, Conversations with Entertainment's Most Enduring Outsiders.
It's great. It's a really good book. And I would think that even if I didn't like Stephen.
Daw. It is the first book published by the AV Club, which is the entertainment section of The Onion. And even though it was largely reprinted material from the paper, it took absolutely freaking forever to put together. Basically, the concept of it is it's interviews with people who are famous, but they're famous in somewhat marginal ways. Kind of an idea that we developed over time at the AV Club, in part because we couldn't get interviews with massively famous people. We sort of got interviews with a lot of C and D list people. And what we found was they were way more interesting than the very famous people on the rare occasions that we got famous people. So we talked to, you know, Mr. T and Elvira and Bob Barker and Rod Roddy and Robert Forster is the last interview in the book, and it's my favorite interview.
And all those interviews you did with David Cross and Bob Odenkirk are in there, I think.
Yeah, and then you have sort of this counter-narrative that runs through the book. As you go through the book, the interviews sort of they start out very, very acerbic and get more sort of cheerful and content. But as you go through the book, I peppered in five interviews with Bob Odenkirk and David Cross from Mr. Show as they get less cheerful and less content. And, I'm very, very proud of the book, and it is its 10th anniversary. And what I realized, and I guess part of what's making me happy about it, is I went, you know, I kind of poked, it's been ages since I'd looked at its Amazon page. You know, I left The Onion 8 years ago. Uh-huh. But I looked at its Amazon page, and the thing is still in print.
Nice.
It is tenaciously, if you will, clinging to it's very appropriate for a book with that title, with that concept, that it would somehow find a way to still be in print.
And I will say that since it is gift-giving time, I will point out that I had this book at one point, and I left it at my parents' house, and my dad sat and read this book. So it is not, and said very kind things about it. It is not a book that is only for sort of people who are into, like, hip, you know, people who sort of consider
the hand gestures of hipness.
I almost had finger guns.
Almost finger guns.
People who consider themselves to be sort of following the absolute, you know, most up-to-the-minute kind of ironic, you know, kind of coverage. It's just really interesting interviews with people who are really interesting. And if you have that relative, not anybody who's too incredibly sensitive to sort of
salty,
you know,
language.
Salty
language. Russ Meyer is in there.
But if you've got that relative where you're like, what would I get this person? A lot of people would dig this book. And I would, like I said, this is not a Stephen-related opinion.
Yeah, and I get no commission off this thing. I don't think The Onion's getting any royalties.
This is my actual opinion. So
thank you.
Tenacity of the Cockroach.
10th anniversary.
Yes. Here is what is making me happy this week. Anne Hathaway was at the New York premiere of Les Miserables, and she was wearing a Tom Ford dress, and she was getting out of a limo. And as sometimes happens to women getting out of limos, and there unfortunately are a number of paparazzi incidents and photographer incidents of this kind of thing, had the dreaded wardrobe malfunction, and essentially, because she was going without underwear, Now, the thing you have to understand about this situation is women who go to this kind of premiere and this kind of event wear all kinds of interesting fashion-forward dresses, some of which, quite frankly, are designed to be worn without underwear. Or it is easiest to wear them without underwear, right, because otherwise your underwear will A, show,
yeah,
or B, make a panty line, which they will also put you in a magazine for. Mm-hmm. So you really kind of can't win with some of these dresses, and it's right, kind of like, we're going to put you in the paper for this, we're going to put you in the paper for this, we're going to put you in the paper. It's not an incredibly, it has a slit up the side, but the dress is not like a, you would never put that dress on unless you kind of wanted everyone to see up your dress.
Oh, yeah, this is a look at me dress.
It is, but it's
vulgar.
Not
way.
In a vulgar.
No, no, no.
Not
as Tim Gunn would say.
Not it's in just a look up my dress way.
Right, right.
But as it happens, you know, she's getting out of the limo. Whatever, they take this. They take this. These shots, and of course, they sell them because, of course,
because people are gross,
I guess. And so she goes on the Today Show, and Matt Lauer, who I normally like.
Mm-hmm.
Matt Lauer decides to really sort of try to get her to talk about this, and is kind of pushing for her to talk about this, and winds up saying to her, because I guess he thinks it's a less gross way to ask the question, what do you learn from that experience?
Right.
First of all, my reaction to that is, that's just disgusting, because you just want to make her talk about it.
Yeah.
She's, what's she supposed to learn? Like, keep my legs together. Like, what? You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah,
wear more underwear, wear different kinds of dresses. What's she supposed to learn from it? So here's Anne Hathaway responding to Matt Lauer's rather gross question.
Well, it was obviously an unfortunate incident.
Yeah.
I think it kind of made me sad on two accounts. One was that I was very sad that we live in an age when someone takes a picture of another person in a vulnerable moment and rather than delete it and do the decent thing, sells it. And I'm sorry that we live in a culture that commodifies sexuality of unwilling participants, which brings us back to Les Mis,
exactly,
because that's what my character is. She is someone who is forced to sell sex to benefit her child because she has nothing and there's no social safety net. And I, yeah, so let's get back to Les Mis.
One of the most creative turns of a question I have ever heard, and I'm going to take it at that. That's fine.
I thought there were two things I loved about this, one of which is, I think it is absolutely fine for a celebrity to say, when I come to a movie premiere, you're welcome to take my picture, you're welcome to photograph me if I make a funny face, that's fine. But if, you know, there's no reason why there's any news value, mm-hmm, in, oh, look, we got to see up her dress. That has no value other than to humiliate her.
Yeah.
And I don't have any problem at all with a celebrity saying, you know what? I just think it's gross. She didn't say, I'm going to sue you. She didn't say,
yeah,
you can't. She just said, it's sad. It's gross. And I think it's sad and gross, too. And I was glad she said that. And I was really glad and impressed by the way that she directed this right back to the movie, which is the jujitsu of the really good interview subject.
The interview turn. Yeah.
Is the sort of like, because at the same time, first of all, it tries to actually direct the interview back to the movie, but it also reminds people that the interview is supposed to be about the movie.
Right.
And it has this way of sort of subtly saying, why are we talking about,
yep,
this?
Yeah.
And I just thought the way she handled it was really, really terrific and encouraging, and I liked it a lot. And it,
yep,
made me happy, because I have absolutely no beef with people saying, yeah, you know what? Taking a picture at my dress is gross.
Yeah.
Gross. Anyway, it made me very, very happy this week.
Good on Anne Hathaway.
And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me in the blog at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, S-T-E-P-H-E-N. You can follow Trey at Trey Graham, Trey with an E, Graham like the cracker. You can follow Glenn at G-H Weldon, W-E-L-D-O-N. You can follow our producer, Jess Gittner, at Jess Gittner, G-I-T-N-E-R. You can follow our music director and producer emeritus, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are listening to right now. Thanks again to all of you who came to the live show. Thank you for listening to this show. Thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
And we will see you back here next week.